It's great today to have David Gossett here for the colloquium. He's our neighbor from across the park. He's a faculty member at the University of Waterloo and the IQC in particular. David is an expert in quantum computing and quantum information. He has had 15 papers accepted already in the QIP conference, the most prestigious conference in quantum information, and three of which were promoted to plenary talks. He has a number of very cool results. I'll just draw your attention briefly to three. He had the 2013 paper in Science showing that multi-particle systems undergoing quantum random walks are capable of universal quantum computation. He had a paper just earlier this year showing us making progress toward proving the 2D area law. In particular, they proved it for 2D frustration-free spin systems. And then he had a paper in 2018, which has already become quite well known, and which he'll, about quantum advantage with shallow circuits, which is what he'll tell us about today. So, David, whenever you're ready, go take it away.
Thank you so much, Latham. And it's a very nice introduction, and very I'm very happy to be talking to all of you today about shallow circuits and the quantum classical boundary. And the works that I'll be talking about today are primarily the first two that are listed here with Bravi, Koenig, and Thoma, Michel. And I'll also mention this third work that's listed here with Daniel Greer, Alex Kirzner, and Luke Schaefer. So as many of you know, the field of quantum computing was essentially formed in the 1980s when Richard Feynman and David Deutsch observed that simulating a quantum system appears to be intractable for classical computers. And so if you could build a computer out of quantum systems, it would appear to be more powerful than the model of computing that existed before then, the classical model that was introduced by Turing in the 30s. And you know, the interest in this idea was really ignited in the 90s when Peter Shor showed that if you had a quantum computer, you could efficiently factor integers and solve discrete log problems. And that was a big surprise because those problems were thought to be very computationally hard, and they were thought to be so hard that they were used to underlie the security of encryption schemes that continue to be used today. And Peter Shor also showed us that quantum information could be protected against errors, and I'll talk more about that in a moment. So this kind of laid the foundation for the, you know, the next 20, 25 years of research in quantum information and quantum computation. And you know, over those decades, we've learned quite a bit about why and in what ways quantum computers can be more powerful than classical computers. And one of the strongest pieces of evidence is today still the quantum algorithms that achieve speedups over the best currently known classical algorithms for certain tasks, such as Shor's algorithm for factoring integers, the algorithms that, you know, were sort of proposed by Feynman and Deutsch, but later formalized by others, including Seth Lloyd, for how to simulate quantum systems using quantum computers, and for other problems that I haven't listed here. We also have other types of evidence that come from the conjectured classical hardness of sampling or for simulating certain types of quantum computations in which, you know, you apply a quantum circuit, measure all the qubits, and, you know, obtain a binary string from some distribution that is not a useful distribution, but nevertheless is thought to be very hard to classically simulate or classically sample from. And this set of ideas has been deployed in a variety of different architectures and types of circuit. Finally, there are provable speedups in a kind of artificial model where the problem instance is given as a kind of black box. So you're given this black box and you want to compute some feature of this black box. The black box computes a function for you, but you're only allowed to use it as a sort of, you know, in terms of its input-output behavior. You don't get to inspect its insides. And using the black box a certain number of times, you want to compute some property of it. And in that, you know, in that setting, we have provable speedups over classical computers that also have, that are also given access to a similar black box. So this is kind of a very brief overview of the types of evidence that we have that quantum computers are more powerful than classical computers. And, you know, of course, quantum computers are not, you know, performing all those algorithms and tasks that I mentioned today. And one of the reasons is that, you know, noise is a challenge. And if you have a quantum circuit, like this is a sort of cartoon picture of a circuit with n qubits on the vertical and the circuit, the width of the circuit, kind of this width is called the circuit depth. And I'll be more precise about that later. But if you just think of it as the width of the circuit, that's okay. So if you have noise in a quantum circuit, then you can sort of roughly think about it as like at each location in the circuit, there's some error with some very small probability p, but let's say it's a constant like 1%. We have a 1% error of 1% chance of an error occurring at each location. Then in that situation, the number of errors will of course be like, you know, scaling with the total circuit size. And so you might throw up your hands and say, well, it doesn't seem very promising because we're going to have a number of errors that is growing with both the number of qubits and the circuit depth. What are we going to do? But as I mentioned before, Peter Shor showed us that error correction is possible and that quantum information can be protected by redundantly encoding logical information into the state of multiple, you know, so if you want to encode a logical qubit, you would encode it into the state of multiple physical qubits. And then by actively correcting errors as they occur, you can preserve the logical state of the qubit and compute fault tolerantly, meaning you can make the errors in the logical state arbitrarily small. And I say here that the overhead is impractical for now. And what I mean is just that, you know, this overhead is sort of thought of from a theorist's perspective as being very, very small. And it doesn't really affect the scaling of algorithms, but it's impractical in the sense that we don't, with current devices, have an extra 50 qubits lying around or even 20 qubits lying around to encode every logical qubit. So what are these quantum computers of today? Well, they're reasonably small. I mean, this is just a screenshot from IBM Quantum's website showing one of their devices with 27 qubits. And they don't incorporate error correction and they are affected by noise. And you can see on this screenshot, they list the error rates for their 2-qubit CNOT gate, and more information can be found about their other devices and other calibration information and so on their website. Just as another example, here's the company IonQ, which makes qubits using a different technology. Their qubits are ions. And again, you can see that they list the fidelity of their single and 2-qubit gates, and these are not perfect devices. You can say, it says here, coming soon, 32 qubits. So again, we're talking about a handful of qubits. Likewise, here's the Google Sycamore processor, which had, I think, 53 working qubits, and which was used for this recent demonstration, which I'll talk about in a moment. So these are devices with a handful of qubits. They don't incorporate error correction, and they are indeed affected by noise. So, you know, it's kind of a pressing question of what can we do with limited or no error correction using, let's say, small circuits or short depth circuits, and ideally using gates that are adapted to the architecture. You know, these devices, the Google and IBM ones I showed you, are laid out in two dimensions. The ion trap devices are typically laid out in one dimension. So this is kind of a question that that addresses what are we going to do with quantum computers of this and maybe the next few generations of devices. And you may have heard about some kind of like practical near-term quantum computing. And the reason you may have heard of that is because there have been several demonstrations on real-world quantum devices for sort of practical sounding problems. And these demonstrations are mostly based on, or are mostly using what I would call heuristic or variational quantum algorithms. And when I say heuristic, what I mean is that we don't really have performance guarantees or understand the scaling of these algorithms, unlike the algorithms I mentioned very early on in the talk. But on the other hand, they are well adapted to a variety of different architectures and can be deployed with a small number of qubits. So they have this advantage that we can implement them, and they have a kind of disadvantage that we don't really understand what they're going to do for us. And so, like, here's an example from the IBM group of some quantum chemistry application where they simulated a water molecule. And likewise, you can find applications in machine learning and optimization. And for now, these are kind of proof of principle demonstrations. And, you know, what I would just like to say is that even if these demonstrations can be scaled up in the presence of noise, which is uncertain, we don't know if there are actual quantum speedups for these problems using the variational or heuristic algorithms. So this is kind of one interesting push with these near-term devices. But I also kind of want to focus on other experiments and another line of attack towards using these devices to convincingly beat classical computers rather than performing useful tasks. And so you may have heard about the proposal from the Google group in 2017, which really has its origins in a line of work that started by Chermel and DiVincenzo in 2002 and was bolstered by important work by Aaronson and others. And this proposal says that, well, if we want to do something classically hard, it suffices to just simulate, to just run a random quantum circuit and measure all the output bits. And so they proposed this in 2017, and then in 2019 ran an experiment using their Sycamore device with 53 qubits and random circuits of depth 20. And they ran the circuit, measured all the qubits, and they get a binary string of length n, which in this case is 53, so they get 53 bits. And that binary string is drawn from a distribution which is correlated with the choice of random circuit. And they have a specific measure of, you know, that measures the correlation between the output distribution and C. And so you can think of it as like kind of a score. And this correlation or score is still detectable even with the noise in their experiment. So this is a kind of measure of correlation that, you know, we think in the case of an ideal circuit should be hard to classically sample from the output distribution. But we, you know, it's the Google group has also conjectured that even in the presence of noise, you know, achieving this kind of score on this correlation measure should be challenging on a classical computer. And the evidence, you know, there's kind of two parts. One is the theoretical evidence, which really has to do with the noise-free implementation. And this rests on some conjectures and a conjecture and complexity theory, but also on a conjecture that it's hard to approximate complex temperature icing model partition functions to a given relative error on average, which is a bit of a mouthful. But these, I think, are plausible and interesting conjectures. And, you know, there's also some kind of empirical evidence for classical hardness, which is that the best classical algorithm running on current classical computers takes much longer than the quantum experiment. But of course, you know, this empirical evidence is only, I think, I think, useful in as much as we believe that the theoretical conjecture is that when n is increased, this problem really becomes much, much harder for classical computers. And of course, the empirical evidence, it's really a moving target because, you know, classical algorithms, often you can shave off a factor of 2 or, you know, a factor of 10 if you're clever, even if the scaling with n is poor. And indeed, like, there has been some recent classical progress which did not simulate the Google experiment, but rather just aimed to spoof their correlation measure to achieve a high score on that correlation measure. And they were able to do this, Pan and Zhang were able to do this using only 5 days on a reasonably small cluster. But on the other side, there was some recent quantum progress which improved the number of qubits and the depth, and that seems to be, you know, maybe that's outside the reach of current classical devices, or maybe we'll be going back and forth for a little while. So this is one example of this kind of like going, you know, attempt to go beyond the power of current classical computers. And I should also mention that there's another very significant attempt based on the boson sampling proposal of Aaronson and Arkhipov, which uses similar arguments to argue that that non-interacting bosons can be used to sample from classically inaccessible distributions. And recently there was an experiment at the University of Science and Technology of China, which implemented a variant of the boson sampling proposal. And this they have this incredible linear optical setup shown here on the left. And the classical simulability of this is the subject of debate. And it's certainly not something I want to jump into in this talk, but I think really the reason that I'm mentioning these things is because, you know, I would like to just argue that we're kind of on this border between quantum and classical. And, you know, this is a cartoon from Wojciech Zurek's 2006 paper on decoherence. And, you know, the original point of the cartoon is that, you know, that you have this quantum domain, which is small things that are governed by quantum mechanics. And then as you go to larger sizes, then things decohere and become more classical. And there's this border between the two. But I would like to repurpose this for in the context of computation. And so on the left, we might think of, you know, a universal fault-tolerant quantum computer with error correction and all of that. And on the far right, we have, you know, the classical computers that we have today. And, you know, this Google experiment and perhaps the boson sampling experiment, those are exploring this border region. And I think, you know, I think that we can ask questions which address this, you know, this question of where the border lies. And these kinds of questions are very interesting to me. And many of them can be phrased as asking what kind of restricted types of quantum computation can be more powerful than classical computers? And on the other hand, which are classically simulable? And in this talk, kind of motivated by this setup, I'll tell you about a new kind of quantum advantage with shallow quantum circuits. So let me be a little bit more precise about shallow quantum circuits and what I mean there. So as I mentioned before, circuit depth is kind of like the width of a circuit, but more precisely, it's the number of time steps in the circuit where we allow for a kind of very trivial parallelism, where when gates, you know, when they don't get applied, when they don't overlap, we allow them to be applied at the same time. So these two gates can be applied at the same time because one of them acts on qubits 1 and 2 and the other acts on qubits 3 and 4. They don't touch one another. So this is another set of 3 gates that can be applied in one time step. And this is 3 more gates that can be applied in one time step. So this is a depth 3 quantum circuit. And when I say shallow quantum circuit, what I mean is a circuit with a constant depth, like 5 or 10, like constant independent of the number of qubits. So I might be interested in like families of circuits where the number of qubits grows, but the depth is just remaining a constant, like 5 or 10 or something like that. And that's what I mean by a shallow quantum circuit. And you know, it's one of the motivating questions for our work is, can shallow quantum circuits be classical computers? Is there a problem where they're better? And there's different versions of this question. And I would say that the kind of more ambitious or challenging version is, can constant depth or shallow quantum circuits perform a task that polynomial time classical computers can't? So classical computers that run in a time that is polynomial in the size of the input. And you know, this would be like more along the lines of the types of questions that are being asked in the context of these demonstrations I told you about before, like the random circuit sampling and so on. And similar arguments can be made, assuming similar conjectures, for the power of constant depth quantum circuits. But just like we can argue under certain conjectures that high depth random circuits can perform these hard sampling tasks, and that boson sampling quantum computers can perform these hard sampling tasks. Similarly, we can make this kind of argument for the power of constant depth quantum circuits for sampling tasks. But you know, I say we believe they can because there are these conjectures, and you know, it does seem to be outside of current techniques to prove those conjectures at the current time. So in our work, we target a kind of less ambitious question, which is, can shallow quantum circuits solve a problem that can't be solved by shallow classical circuits? And So here we're just trying to set up a comparison between shallow quantum circuits and their classical counterparts. And there we're able to prove this outright. And so that is what I'm going to tell you about in the rest of the talk. So in the first part, I'll talk about this work with Rob and Koenig from 2018, where we showed that there's a linear algebra problem that can be solved by shallow quantum circuits, but provably can't be solved by shallow classical circuits. And then in the second part, at the end, I'll tell you about follow-up work where we show that this separation between shallow quantum and shallow classical persists even in the presence of noise. And at that point, I'll try to convince you that it's not a trivial consequence of quantum error correction. Now, I do want to add this caveat that the advantage that we show here for this linear algebra problem is not very dramatic. So we show that classical circuits require a depth that increases at least logarithmically with the input size. So we're talking about a logarithmic increase versus constant depth. But that being said, it does have a kind of different nature than many of the other pieces of evidence that I mentioned before. And so if we, just to compare, if we just compare our quantum advantage with shallow circuits with some of these other types of evidence, this quantum, it is a small advantage, but it is provable and non-oracular. Whereas these other types of advantage, in some ways, they're certainly more powerful. Like the types of advantage we think that you get for these other problems can be exponential. But you could, if you wanted to poke holes in them, you could say, well, these speedups could disappear if the classical algorithms can be improved. And these speedups assume complexity theoretic and other conjectures that we can't prove, and that we don't live in a world with black box oracles, so we have to imagine implementing them with functions that have structure, and then we don't know if those speedups can be preserved. So it does have a kind of different nature, and it's also this advantage with shallow circuits. It comes from a different place, and so that's what I'll tell you about in the rest of the talk. Okay. Are there any questions at this point?
Maybe I'll just ask one. You might have said this, but is there any restriction that the gates have to operate only on 2 qubits or some finite number of qubits?
For the quantum or the classical?
Well, I was thinking for the quantum case.
Yeah, so since we're showing that this family of quantum circuits is powerful, it actually, if we restrict the gates to act only on a few qubits, that's sort of better for us because we show that a more limited class is powerful. But indeed, we work with kind of the standard quantum circuit model, and the gates can be made to be 1 and 2 qubit gates on a 2D grid. Yeah. In the classical case, the reason I ask is that in the classical case, we actually allow the classical circuits a little bit more power. And so they don't have to have, we'll talk about that later, but yeah, in the quantum case, we're talking about 1 and 2 qubit gates.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let me now jump into how shallow quantum circuits can beat shallow classical circuits. And so what I'm going to tell you about is this linear algebra problem that shallow quantum can solve and shallow classical can't. And we're going to define the problem in two equivalent ways. And one of those ways involves simulating a certain quantum procedure that involves measurements on a graph state. I'll explain what that is. And the other equivalent way involves computing a certain property of a quadratic form mod 4. And the terminology, the name, the hidden linear function problem, it's not at all going to be clear what it means until we get to the second definition. Okay, so hold tight. But the first definition is, I think, more natural, at least for those of us in quantum computing. So I'll start with that. Okay, so what is this problem? Well, an instance of the problem is defined by a symmetric n by n binary matrix A. So this is a matrix of zeros and ones, which is symmetric. And you can equivalently think of this, first of all, if you just look at the off-diagonal part of A, so just ignore the diagonal, and then this defines the adjacency matrix of a graph on n vertices. So you can think of it as just telling you, which vertices are connected in an n-vertex graph. And then you can think of the diagonal part of A as specifying a subset of marked vertices. Okay, these are the entries that are one on the diagonal. So if you don't like thinking about n by n symmetric binary matrices, you can think of the input as specified by a graph on n vertices and a subset of marked vertices that I've shown here in green. Okay. Now, to tell you what the problem is, I want you to first consider a certain quantum procedure. So the procedure begins by preparing the quantum graph state corresponding to the given graph. So what does that mean? Well, imagine placing a qubit at each vertex of the graph in the zero state, then applying single qubit Hadamard gates to all the qubits. You don't need to know what the Hadamard gate is. It's just a single qubit gate. I mean, I'll put its definition on a slide in a couple slides, but for now, if you don't know what it is, it's just a specific single qubit gate. So you apply the single qubit Hadamard gate to all the qubits, then you apply two qubit controlled Z gates on all the edges in any order. Okay, so that's how you prepare the quantum graph state. It's a state that is associated with any graph, okay? And then I want you to imagine taking that state and measuring each qubit in either the Pauli X basis, and we're going to do that for vertices that are unmarked, or the Pauli Y basis, and we're going to measure in the Y basis if the vertex is marked. So if you do this, then you will get a binary string of length n, which tells you all of these measurement outcomes, one for every qubit. And the hidden linear function problem can be defined as follows. Given the graph and the subset of marked vertices, output any measurement outcome, that is any binary string of length n, that occurs with non-zero probability in the above experiment. Okay, so this is a problem where for each instance, there are many valid solutions, or there could be many, in principle, there could be many valid solutions. And this is just one way to define this problem. And of course, this way of defining it, like we've defined it in terms of a simple quantum circuit that solves the problem, right? Because the quantum circuit just prepares all the qubits in the zero state, applies the single qubit Hadamards, controlled Zs, and then measures. But I said that we're going to be interested in shallow quantum circuits, and we want the problem to be solvable by shallow quantum circuits of constant depth. And that's not always going to be the case for this hidden linear function problem. So we're going to restrict it a little bit. And we're going to consider instances where the graph is a subgraph of a 2D grid. So that, if we make that restriction, then this whole quantum experiment can be done in constant depth. And so then it's also going to be useful for us to consider the two-dimensional or 2D hidden linear function problem, where the graph that's given to you is a subgraph of a root n by root n grid. Okay, so that's the definition of the problem. And as I said, there's a constant depth quantum circuit that solves the 2D hidden linear function problem. So here's our grid, and we can represent our instance as a subgraph and a subset of marked vertices. And then to solve the instance, we just Hadamard all the qubits, apply controlled Zs on all the red edges, and then we rotate the qubits to either the Y basis or the X basis. So we can do that using a layer of phase gates and a layer of Hadamard gates. And then we measure, and that's the constant depth quantum circuit that solves this problem. Okay, so I hope that I've explained the definition of the problem, and we've seen that there's a quantum circuit that solves it in constant depth. And it also has this nice feature that the gates act between nearest neighbor qubits in a 2D geometry. But it also, this circuit that I just showed you, it also has another very special feature that is a little bit harder to explain. So I'm going to just do that now in a couple of slides. And the feature that it has is it's what's known as a Clifford circuit, which is a family of circuits that is generated by the following one and two qubit gates: the Hadamard, the phase, and the controlled Z gate. And Clifford circuits are not powerful enough to implement most quantum algorithms. And they're actually an extremely special subfamily of quantum circuits. And the reason they're special is because, as we learned from the Gauss-McNeil theorem, they quantum circuits that are composed only of such gates can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer using linear algebra. And so this quantum circuit that solves the 2D hidden linear function problem is a Clifford circuit. And you know, one of the ways to understand the Gauss-McNeil theorem is by understanding the types of states that are prepared by Clifford circuits. And one can show that you can track these states through the course of the circuit using linear algebra. And the quantum states that are prepared by such circuits, they're called stabilizer states. And one can show that they have a compact classical representation, which is as follows. You can define a stabilizer state in terms of, or specify one, in terms of an affine subspace of binary strings, a quadratic function, and a linear function. And the quadratic and linear functions, they tell you about the phase of the quantum state, and the affine subspace tells you the support. And so, one way to understand the Gauss-McNeil theorem is to use this kind of characterization of the set of states prepared by Clifford circuits, and every time you apply a gate to learn how, you know, to figure out how to update this representation, that's one way to show the Gauss-McNeil theorem. But for us, the reason I bring this up is because it's possible to use this characterization to get an equivalent definition of the hidden linear function problem that involves only classical things, and in particular quadratic forms. So we can sort of translate the definition that I gave you before that involves measurements on quantum graph states into a math problem involving quadratic forms. So let me do that now. So again, like the input is the same as before, it's a symmetric n by n binary matrix. It's going to be convenient to define the kernel of this matrix, which is the set of binary strings that are annihilated by it mod 2. And then it's also going to be convenient to define a quadratic form, X transpose AX mod 4. And here it's important that this is a mod 4 and not a mod 2. And you know, it's not a typo that there's a mod 4 here and a mod 2 here. Now, we are going to be interested in the value of this quadratic form for inputs X that are in the kernel of A. So let me just, to help understand what's going on here, let's just suppose for a moment that this was a mod 2 and not a mod 4, okay? So if I looked at this quadratic form at inputs in the kernel, it would just vanish, right? It would just be 0 because A annihilates X mod 2. And so then you would have the situation where you have a quadratic function and it drops down to a constant function when you look at its inputs in this kernel. And with the mod 4 rather than the mod 2, something more interesting happens. And it's very easy to show that it drops down to a linear function. So if you inspect, if you look at the quadratic form, but only look at inputs in the kernel of A, then you will find that there is a hidden linear function hidden inside the quadratic function. And you can parameterize that linear function by a binary string Z that tells you, you know, what the linear function is. And that binary string Z is not unique. And the hidden linear function problem is, you know, given this matrix A, find the linear function that's hidden inside the quadratic one. Or, you know, equivalently find a parameterization of that function, which is a binary string Z. Okay. And with this formulation, it's easy to sort of more directly see how to solve this problem in polynomial time on a classical computer using linear algebra. Because what we can do is first, we can solve for a basis of the kernel of A mod 2 using just, you know, linear algebra over the binary field. And then each one of those basis vectors, x1 up to xk, we can plug into the equation Q of X equals 2Z transpose X. And then each one of those basis vectors gives us a linear equation for Z. So the next step is to then solve that system of linear equations. So we have to do linear algebra twice. And this is an algorithm with, you know, runtime order n cubed. Okay. So we've defined this kind of unusual linear algebra problem. We saw a kind of natural quantum definition and a kind of strange classical definition in terms of quadratic forms. And we saw that it can be solved in constant depth by a quantum computer. And this is only interesting, of course, because we also show that it cannot be solved in constant depth by a classical computer. And now, you know, you should ask, and this is what I was anticipating before, you know, what family of shallow classical circuits should we compare against here? And, you know, of course we want the circuit to be constant depth, but, you know, what kind of gates should we have? And, you know, I would argue that the analogous classical circuit would have gates with constant number of inputs and constant number of outputs. And, you know, we're also going to allow it to be a probabilistic circuit, which means that we feed it random input bits, as many as it wants. And I would argue that that is the natural quantum classical analog of the family of circuits that we are using. But as I kind of alluded to before, we're going to give the classical circuit a bit more power than this. And we're only going to require the gates to have a constant number of inputs, which is called the fan-in. So here, x1 up to xk, those are all inputs to a classical gate that computes function f. And we're going to require that this k is a constant, like, you know, 5 or 10 or something, independent of n. Now, with classical gates, you can copy the output f of x later on in the circuit to as many locations as you like. So we're not going to bound the number of times that that happens. So this f of x could be, you know, on the right-hand side, the fan out can be arbitrarily large. We're not going to restrict that. So that's the sense in which we're giving these classical circuits, you know, potentially more power. Okay, and what do we show? Well, we show that if you have a classical circuit and it's made up of these gates with constant number of inputs, and let's say that you require that, so here I've drawn it pictorially and I've written kind of the same thing in words above. So the circuit takes as input this instant, you know, the matrix A that defines the instance. It also can take our random bits, and we allow them to be from any joint distribution. They don't have to be uniformly random. And then we require that the classical circuit outputs a solution to the given instance of the 2D hidden linear function problem with probability at least 7/8. And we show that if that is the case, then the circuit has depth at least a constant times log n. So in other words, it's increasing with n and not constant. Okay, now the proof of this is kind of perhaps the most interesting part. So the proof, it exploits the tension between shallow classical circuits, which really you should think of as some kind of local function. So when I say locality in shallow classical circuits, we'll see in a moment that every output bit can only depend on a constant number of input bits. And so in that sense, they're local functions. And there's a tension between that and this idea of quantum non-locality in the sense of, you know, Bell and Einstein and Merman, that measurement statistics of entangled quantum states can't be reproduced by local hidden variable models. Now, a local hidden variable model is not the same as a shallow classical circuit. In fact, it's a weaker model. You should think of a shallow circuit as generalizing local hidden variable models to a potentially more powerful class. And on the other hand, we're not allowing any entangled quantum state. We're requiring that it be prepared by a constant depth quantum circuit. We're also, in a sense, limiting the power of the quantum model. But we show that the outputs of these constant depth quantum circuits have a kind of strong form of quantum non-locality that can be not just local hidden variable models, but also this more powerful model of shallow quantum classical circuits. And let me give a little bit more detail there. So here's like a classical circuit, and let's focus our attention on one of the output bits, Z1, and we can trace it back through the circuit and find all of the input bits that it depends on. And here they are. And so this would be called the light cone of the output bit Z1. It's the set of input bits that can change its value. So no matter what assignment to the X's are at the input, flipping X4 can never change the value of Z1 because it's not in its light cone. Okay, so that's the notion of a light cone. And What's special about shallow classical circuits? Well, what's special about it is that if you have a depth D classical circuit and all the gates have at most capital K input, so the fan in is at most capital K, then every light cone of every output bit has size upper bounded by K to the D, which is a constant. So every output bit depends on a constant number of input bits, and that includes the random input bits, for example. So let's call this notion of locality, we'll call it constant depth locality. That's going to be my shorthand for, you know, saying that light cones of output bits have constant size. And what we show is that this 2D hidden linear function problem can't be solved by any circuit with that property. And so to help kind of build up to that, it's going to be convenient to first consider a kind of more restrictive form of locality that is, that comes from the usual kind of Bellman locality. And this, so what I'm doing here is I'm going to just tell you the famous GHC non-local game, but in the language of circuits, okay? So I want you to imagine a what I would call a completely local circuit with three input bits, B1, B2, and B3, and three output bits, Z1, Z2, and Z3, but the output bits, just for convenience, are -1 or 1, not 0 or 1, okay? And this is completely local because every output bit is just a function of its corresponding input bit, okay? So there's no, just what I said. Now, we're going to augment this completely local classical circuit with random input bits, and we're going to allow the random input bits to be shared between these three functions, F1, F2, and F3. Okay, so we have shared randomness and completely local circuit. And this is what's known as a local hidden variable model in this context. Okay. Now, the GHC example considers the following input-output behavior. Suppose that you want your circuit to have the property that when the input bits are all zeros, the output bits multiply to one. And likewise for the other three cases considered here. Let's call this the GHC relation. So if you want that input-output relation, it's not hard to show that you cannot get it with this type of circuit. It's just, there's only so many circuits of this type, and you can just fairly easily show that it's just not possible to get this kind of input-output relation. On the other hand, it can be realized by a kind of quantum analog of this completely local circuit where we replace the functions F1, F2, and F3 with unitaries followed by measurement, and we replace the shared randomness with a shared 3-qubit entangled state, the GHC state. And what does the circuit do in this case? Well, it just measures each qubit in the X or Y basis depending on the corresponding input bit. Okay, so this is the GHC example. And it kind of shows if you have a completely local circuit, and in the quantum case, if you have an entangled input state, then you can beat this local hidden variable model or completely local classical circuit. Now, as I said, we have to go beyond this because we want, first of all, we are not going to allow ourselves to be given an entangled state. We need to prepare it in constant depth. And second of all, we want to beat any shallow classical circuit, not just these completely local families. So to go beyond that, a key part of our proof is this construction by Baer et al., which is really like a stretched out version of the GHC example. And in our language, you can think about it as a special family of HLF instances that cannot be solved with geometrically local classical circuits in one dimension. So what is this example? Well, again, we're going to consider a graph state on a cycle. In this case, I've drawn it as a triangle. And the reason I drew it as a triangle is because we're going to choose three special qubits, U, V, and W. And so we prepare this graph state, and then we're going to imagine measuring the qubits at the vertices U, V, and W in either the X or Y basis, depending on a given input bit. And then we're going to measure all the other qubits in the X basis. And it's possible to show that after you measure these qubits in the X basis, the ones on the edges, you're left with a GHC state modified by a correction that depends on those measurement outcomes. So you're kind of, after you measure, if you imagine measuring these qubits on the edges first, then you're really playing, you know, a version of this GHC game, but the version of the game you're playing, like the entangled state you're given, depends on these measurement outcomes. So it's very closely related to the GHC example. And what is shown in this Barrett paper is that if you want to have the same input-output statistics as this quantum experiment, then there must be an output bit somewhere on this triangle that is correlated with a distant input bit on the triangle. Meaning, so there's three input bits, one at U, one at V, one at W. And so like if, when I say a distant input bit, I mean like if you're over here, for example, you'd be correlated with either V or W, like not the nearest input bit. Okay, so in order to kind of have the same input-output relation as this quantum experiment using a classical circuit, you need to have correlations that are geometrically non-local. And so how do we then boost this into showing that the 2D hidden linear function problem is hard for classical shallow circuits? Well, you know, we can, in a 2D grid, there's a lot of different cycles we can draw, right? So here's one of them. And we can choose these special vertices U, V, and W. And we can define an instance of the hidden linear function problem that corresponds to that cycle and corresponds to the measurements that we're interested in from the Barrett example. And if you have a classical circuit that solves this 2D hidden linear function problem, then from that Barrett example, we learned that it has to have geometrically non-local correlations with respect to every one of these cycles that we can draw on the grid. And once you have that, it's not much more to show that that's not possible for shallow classical circuits or for any circuit where the correlation structure, you know, where every light cone has constant size, it's just not possible to have all of those geometrically non-local correlations. And in particular, we show using a kind of probabilistic argument that you can always, you know, unless the light cones have size at least some power of n, you know, we show n to the 1/8, then you can't have this kind of correlation structure. And so this gives us, using the relationship between the light cone size and the depth, which is, remember, the fan in to the depth is the upper bound on the light cone size. So we get a depth lower bound of log n over 8 log k, where k is the maximum fan in. Okay. And so since our work appeared, there have been several extensions. So I want to just mention some of them here. One of the important circuit families in classical complexity theory is the family AC0, which is AND circuits composed of AND and OR gates with unbounded fan-in. Remember that we bound the number of inputs to each gate, but this circuit family AC0 has unbounded fan-in and constant depth. And it was shown by Benning, Watts, Kothari, Schaefer, and Toll that even if you allow the classical shallow circuits to use this family of shallow circuits, they still cannot solve the 2D HLF problem. A kind of slightly more technical result due to Greer and Schaefer showed that if the problem is turned into an interactive problem where part of the question is asked in round one and another part is asked in round two, then you can strengthen the separation even more. And you know, you can give the classical circuits even more power and they still can't solve this problem. You might ask if the two-dimensional nature of our algorithm is necessary, or whether or not it's possible to get the same kind of separation using a quantum circuit laid out in one dimension. And in this paper from 2020, we showed that indeed you can use a kind of stretched out version of the Norman magic square game to get a quantum advantage in one dimension this way. Now, I've been talking about quantum speedups, and we're talking about a speedup as measured by the depth. But you could also ask if there's a speedup as measured by the total number of operations or gates. And in this paper with Greer, Kersner, and Schaefer, we considered this question. And why would you think this? Well, the shallow quantum circuit, you know, it has a constant number of layers, and in each layer, you can have a linear number of gates. So the total number of gates in this shallow quantum circuit is linear in n. On the other hand, the linear algebra algorithm that I showed you, you know, that has a cubic runtime. So you might ask whether or not this is a polynomial quantum speedup or a linear algebra problem. And it seems unlikely that one would be able to prove this using current techniques for lower bounding the number of operations in a classical circuit are too weak to really address this. But you can try to improve the classical algorithms, and that's one thing that we did here. So first we showed that any shallow Clifford circuit can be simulated with runtime scaling as n to the omega, where omega is the exponent that governs matrix multiplication. This is not really surprising because it's a linear algebra problem, but this was kind of a first step that had not been shown before. So omega is known to be between 2 and roughly 2.37. And some people think that it should meet the lower bound, but the jury is still out. But then we show that if for planar Clifford circuits, like the ones that are used to solve the 2D HLF problem, you can get a square root speed up over even that runtime. And using a kind of recursive approach where you solve some solve for the grid, you would like divide it in four and solve four subproblems and then piece them together and sort of recurse. And so for any shallow Clifford circuit in a planar geometry, we can simulate that on a classical computer in runtime n to the omega over 2. So this is kind of interesting because then if omega is 2, this would mean that classical computers could solve the 2D HLF problem using the same number of gates as quantum computers. On the other hand, this optimism about a speed up in terms of number of gates, you know, I don't think it's really dashed by this result because everything I said above is true if we consider the hidden linear function problem on a sparse graph, so a graph where every vertex has constant degree. But this kind of divide and conquer algorithm that can work for planar graphs, typically we don't know how to make that sort of algorithm work for sparse graphs. And so I think the HLF problem on sparse graphs is a good candidate for polynomial quantum speed up in terms of gate complexity. And finally, you know, a very important question that was left open by our work is whether or not it works in the presence of noise. And that was going to be the subject of the second part of my talk. And I think I have essentially run out of time. So I will try to be as reasonably fast in this section. So first of all, like what kind of noise model or how should we think about noise in circuits? And I mentioned before that you can just think of like errors occurring at each location with some small probability p, and that is a perfectly fine way to think about noise in this part of the talk as well. Okay, so just think of this noise model where each qubit is corrupted with probability p after every layer of gates. Now, why does noise cause a problem? Like I mentioned before, we already know that quantum error correction exists, so why can't we just kind of say the words quantum error correction and be done with it? Well, here's the kind of schematic of the circuit which solves this 2D hidden linear function problem. The input A is given at the top, and we have a Clifford circuit that depends on that input. So it's sort of controlled Clifford circuit. And then, of course, we measure all the qubits at the end. Now, if, you know, obviously you can't just use this circuit in the presence of noise because the output will be corrupted on a constant fraction of the output bits. So that's not okay. You can't just use it without error correction. But then if you just try to naively use error correction, what will you do? Well, you'll encode every logical qubit into m physical qubits, where m is, say, polylogarithmic in n, using some quantum error correcting code. And then you will replace each of the gates in the Clifford circuit with their logical counterparts adapted to the error correcting code. And then after you make all the measurements, you can decode the quantum error correcting code and get the output that you want. So that would be like a standard use of quantum error correction. But the problem, so obviously we would want to choose an error correcting code where the 1 and 2 qubit logical Clifford gates can be performed by constant depth circuits. And that's fine, you can easily find codes like that. And that's good because it makes this middle part constant depth. It remains constant depth after encoding. But the bad news is that neither this encoding step nor the decoding step is constant depth for the error correcting codes that we know. So we kind of have two problems to deal with, the encoding problem and the decoding problem, because these encoding and decoding operations are not constant depth. The decoding problem is purely, it's purely classical step. After measurement, you decode. So our solution to that is to just fold it into the problem definition. We can just define a new problem so that the thing on the left, the Y bit string, is the solution to the new problem, if and only if the decoded thing is a solution to the old problem. So that part is reasonably easy to handle. The encoding problem is tricky, and the problem is that we cannot prepare the encoded input state in constant depth. And so instead, what we can do is we can prepare a kind of corrupted version of the encoded input state along with the binary string that tells us what the corruption is. And that can be done in constant depth for a certain type of stabilizer codes. And this turns out to be good enough for us because the kind of corruption that occurs here is a Pauli operator, and the Clifford circuit plays nicely with that Pauli operator. So this is actually good enough for us. But we have another problem, which is that there could be errors in this step. And when there are errors in this step, they can spread. So we need a kind of very special kind of state preparation, which is called single shot state preparation, which has only been shown for certain esoteric codes. And if we put all those ingredients together, we are able to convert our original quantum circuit that solves the 2D HLF problem, or any other circuit of this form, we can convert it to a kind of a new circuit, which solves a different problem, which is related to the old one by some ingredients that involve the quantum error correcting code and its decoding procedure. And then this new circuit, even if you implement it in the presence of noise, it will satisfy this new problem. It will solve the new problem. So that's good. And then we have to show that the new noise tolerant problem is not much easier for classical circuits than the old problem. And we do that. And we infer a lower bound that is almost as good as we had before. So it's log n over log n. Okay, so as I said, you can take a computational problem defined by a controlled Clifford circuit and make it noise tolerant without making it easier for classical circuits. But our whole thing relies on the existence of certain type of quantum error correcting codes. And we actually show that all of these requirements are met by the well-known surface code. And that required development of a single shot logical state preparation procedure for that code that was not previously known, but which is based on an earlier work of Rausendorf, Ravi, and Harrington. Okay, so that brings me to the end, and I apologize, I think I've gone maybe a minute over time, a few minutes over time. So I'll just leave these questions and concluding remarks here and pause for questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Feel free to unmute to give David a round of applause for that talk. Can I start by asking whether there are any questions from students? Anybody? If not, oh, yes, Aman, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you for the great talk. I just wanted to ask, I might have missed this in the presentation, this hidden linear function problem, you talked about it's in quantum circuits like a shallow depth problem. Does it have any dependence on the number of qubits required or the number of qubits can be anything in classical and quantum case?
We allow the circuits to have as many qubits as you like. In the quantum case, you know how many qubits you need to solve the problem because the circuit is just, I showed you the circuit, but in the classical case, we don't restrict the number of bits that are given. And as I mentioned, you can be given this kind of very seemingly very powerful random input bits from any joint distribution, but somehow it still doesn't help.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions from anyone else? Rob, it briefly looked like you had a question. Did you?
Yeah, I can ask my question. You showed this nice connection with Barrett et al.'s kind of embedded GHZ example. If one asks, you know, how do you make a proof of non-locality that looks like that, you know, robust to noise? So if I start with, like, you know, how do I make the GHZ proof robust to noise? Now, the answer I would give is use a Bell-type inequality. So Merman derives some inequalities that are violated by the GHZ example, but are also violated by, you know, noisy versions of GHZ up to some amount of noise. And so what I would expect that in the Barrett et al. Example, you could also do something like that, derive inequalities that if you violate them, you know, prove that you can't have a local explanation. So I'm just curious whether there's an alternative avenue to showing noise robustness of your result.
That's a great, I think that's a really great question. And I would love it if there was a way to do it in a way that, I mean, I think our method is, you know, natural, maybe only from a quantum computing point of view, right? I mean, it involves error correction and all of this stuff. So it would be really great to understand if there was like a version of this problem that is naturally noise tolerant in the way that you mentioned. One challenge with that, and the reason that I think it doesn't work kind of in a straightforward way, is that in this Barrett example, you know, so you could, as I mentioned before, like when you measure all these qubits on the edges in the X basis, now you have a GHZ state at these vertices U, V, and W, and it's modified by a Pauli correction that depends on these measurement outcomes. But, you know, what's relevant here is kind of the parity of these measurement outcomes that determines the Pauli correction. So if you imagine that these edges are very long, like order n bits, then the parity is a very delicate function, like whether or not it's, you know, the measurement outcomes are 0 or 1 mod 2. That's delicate. And, you know, when you have a, you know, if you make those measurements and corrupt just one of them by an error, the parity information is completely lost. So I think that it's not true that this Barrett example is naturally robust to noise. And I think our 2D hidden linear function problem has the same failing. But that being said, you know, I actually think that this question of whether or not there are problems naturally robust to noise, I think it's related to this seemingly unrelated problem that I mentioned at the end here, which is whether or not quantum non-locality can play a role in quantum optimization algorithms, because those are algorithms where the output is kind of checked by a local function. So like in Bell experiments, you know, you have a kind of, you have a function that just depends on the two players. And so it's local in the sense that it only depends on two outputs. But when we have these kind of stretched out versions, now the way that you check that something's a solution involves looking at parities of long string. And so, you know, we lose the locality of the checking, and that leads to what I think is directly related to the kind of lack of noise tolerance.
Okay, thanks.
Sophia, maybe one last question.
Yeah, hello. Actually, we're a group of people, so streaming the talk. With respect to the end of the talk, the decoding and encoding section, could you maybe explain in more depth why the problem and still stays, let's say, in the same class of problems?
Do you mean like why it's still hard for classical circuits?
Yes, or...
Yeah, I sped over that. So the, you know, we define this new problem and you know, it's noise tolerant because it's defined using this error correcting code, but, you know, to prove that it's not much easier, we show that you can take an output of this noise tolerant circuit, the quantum circuit, and then compute using a low depth classical circuit with reasonably small fan, and you can compute a solution to the old problem. So, so that means that, you know, if it's hard to compute a solution to the old problem with shallow circuits, then it's also hard to compute a solution to the new problem, because you can just reduce one to the other in this way. There is this funny thing that the fan in is not constant anymore, And that leads directly to this loss of log n in our depth lower bound.
So. Right, yes, I'm just reading the slide a bit, but I think that makes it clear. Okay, thank you.
All right, wonderful. Well, in view of time, why don't we thank David one more time for a great talk.